This is Jim Inkster. Coming today, we will talk with Steve Monahan, the president of the Louisiana Federation of Teachers, the state's largest teacher union. Steve's held that position at LFT for the last decade, and this is an interesting time in education. Governor Jindal has denounced as shameful a lawsuit filed last week by the U.S. Department of Justice to block implementation of parts of the state school vouchers program. And Steve Monahan and LFT are asking a district judge to toss out a state law that makes it harder for public school teachers to earn and retain tenure. We'll talk about it. Also, John Word of the Advocate, the latest on music and movies in our community. Some big performers have been here over the last few months, and we'll talk with John Word about the likes of Kevin Costner, Beyonce, Smokey Robinson, and Audra McDonald. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Your numbers are 877-217-5757. And locally, 297-5633. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. We start with Steve Monahan, the New Orleans native who was elected president of the Louisiana Federation of Teachers 10 years ago. 10 years now.
10 short years.
And much is happening on the education front, and we'll talk with Steve Monahan, who began his career as a teacher. He was in the classroom for how long?
I think it was 12 years.
In the New Orleans and Jefferson Parish area. How was that experience? How has that shaped your vision as head of LFT?
It was at the foundation of who I am now, because the battles were much the same. My first teaching experience was at Carver Senior High School. It was many years ago. I was teaching English, and the program was called Education Through Innovation. Well, the innovative piece of it, from looking at it retrospectively, was the fact that I had one set of books for six sections of freshman English. And told, please don't let these books leave the classroom, because if you do, there are no replacements. So as we move into the 21st century, it's still a question of, do we have the resources to get the job done?
Mm-hmm. Well, today is the 120th anniversary of the birth of Huey Pierce Long in Winfield, Louisiana, a governor who had an impact on education, certainly with textbooks, right?
Yep. He certainly did, and other comparisons could be made, I'm sure.
Well, let's compare him with our current governor.
Well, in the session of 2012, where the latest, I think, newsmaking issue, now orbs here, there were comparisons made to the current governor to Governor Long in regard to the brunt force of politics in regard to passing legislation. Both of the disputed bills that we've been dealing with are acts, controversial acts, Acts 1 and Acts 2, which have been in the courts now for since June of 2012. Both of those acts were bulldozed through the legislature like nothing we've seen in the modern history of legislating. So when we go back to the comparison with Governor Long, I certainly wasn't there then. I just have read. But that was the notable comparison, that we haven't seen anything blitzkrieg like that to the days of Governor Long.
Huey Long? Well, yeah. They both were young men in a hurry. Huey, of course, had aspirations to run for president before he was shot down at the age of 42. Same age Governor Jindal is right now, by the way. And this governor has been... he's taken stands that you have not appreciated, and that was again in focus yesterday when your group requested in court that a law that was passed to be tossed out because it makes it harder for public school teachers to earn and retain tenure. What's going on with this particular legislative maneuver?
Well, again, what a tangled web. This all has, I guess... How do we say it? I guess I shouldn't say deceive. That wouldn't be appropriate. Let me just say it very, very simply. The legislation that was passed in 2012 has created a firestorm. It was hastily drafted. It was poorly conceived. And there was very little public input. So we ended up with two bad acts. Act one, which was in the news yesterday, involving teacher tenure. We filed a lawsuit against that act in June of 2012. In March of 2013, Judge Caldwell ruled the entire act unconstitutional because of the bundling of multi-issues or objects into one piece of legislation. The state quickly appealed, and they sent it to the Supreme Court. So we had Act 2 that Judge Kelly had ruled unconstitutional in the use of the MFP dollars. We now have Act 1 ruled unconstitutional because of multi-objects. Both are before the Supremes. In May, the Supremes ruled and affirmed Judge Kelly. And a week or so later in the session, Act 1 was sent back to Judge Caldwell for reconsideration. It was remanded back to the judge. So in the heat of the summer, we awaited to back to school. The complaints start coming in as we do expected them, that the process in regarding evaluation associated with Act 1 and the process of getting due process were corrupted. So here's what we said, Jim. If we allow ourselves to move forward, districts all over the state of Louisiana are going to find themselves in an adversarial relationship with their employees, not because of their malfeasance or misinterpretation of law, but because the law itself is flawed. So we're asking Judge Caldwell to once again, because it's already been done once, declare Act 1 unconstitutional on the grounds that it is a multi-object bill. We stick to that, and I think we even have better evidence now that the Supremes have weighed in on it. And also add to it that the due process that's provided in that act violates both the state and the U.S. Constitution in regard to what qualifies or passes as fair process. That's it in a nutshell. Right, we're trying to stop a train wreck.
Well, the governor says that tougher tenure rules will improve teacher quality and student achievement. Do you think that's the case?
I think there's always room to fix anything, and we were completely willing and still are to have a tenure process that makes a little more sense than the one that was in place in the past. However, what the governor and the legislative body in 2012 passed didn't make sense. And I'll share with you, I got a letter from a teacher, and I'm getting quite a few of these, but this one particularly touched me. It's a little outside of the courtroom. It's more in the classroom. And she's asking for help. She said, after going through my student data, I noticed several issues. I have students that have missed 60 or more days of school that scored on their value-added model would consider them as not showing growth. But since they didn't have 20 consecutive missed days, they contributed to my score. Discipline problems, students that weren't in the classroom because of discipline problems, contributed to my score. I had a student that grew 30 points, but the expectation of the state was that they were to grow by 55 points. I was held accountable for that. Bottom line, Jim, is this teacher was rated highly effective by her principal and highly effective in every other measure of her evaluation. But because of the value-added model, which he has no right to contest under the state law or the Bessie Board rules, she is rated ineffective right now, meaning her salary is frozen. She does not move up on the salary schedule. She loses tenure. She has no tenure. She is a beginning teacher again. That, to me, is beyond the issues that are going to be in the courtroom, which are really heady issues of due process and what fair process means. When you get to a teacher like this who has been a dedicated teacher in the district, and it's in Lake Charles, is now being penalized for something that makes absolutely no sense, and that our own superintendent of education has indicated that he continues to work on to fix, to tweak. And we shouldn't be flying the plane if it isn't ready to fly.
Well, on another front, Governor Jindal last week denounced as shameful a lawsuit filed by the U.S. Department of Justice to block the implementation of parts of the state school vouchers program. The program, known as the Louisiana Scholarship Program, allows students to transfer out of failing public schools and into private schools using taxpayer dollars. The Department of Justice claims the program affects the racial balance in some districts that are still under federal desegregation orders. Your thoughts about this development?
Could see it coming from a million miles away. The Justice Department's been hovering around the state of Louisiana and with great interest since the passage of Act II. And there is a certain amount of arrogance that contributes to the petition from the federal government. Leaving all the insults out of whether it's shameful and all the rhetoric that always surrounds these kinds of issues, and, of course, the race issue that surrounds these issues, the fault is we have an act that was hastily passed, that the discussion, there was an incomplete conversation about the potential effects on the DSEG cases around the state, and it was brushed off. And we have a continued arrogance and the failure, according to the petition, of the state to respond to simple questions from the federal government regarding how this is affecting the respective districts. We know this. Districts that are already struggling for resources that lose students have fewer resources to help the students that are still in their buildings. So it's a logical outcome. And to me, and to many that deal with this, until we all are able to sit down and say, hey, it's got to be fixed. It makes no sense either on the Act 1 and the way teachers are evaluated or on Act 2 and the way that we're moving resources we don't have into to unaccountable different experiments, we're going to have litigation and we're going to have discord in our schools.
Well, as school has started around the state, teachers have a little bigger budget to work with. Does that mean that by and large teachers are earning more money in Louisiana today than they were a year ago?
If we're talking about the little money that came out of the legislative session, all money's appreciated, but we're talking about couch change. Some teachers will receive many of them will receive less than $200 more than they had received. Keeping in mind that many teachers have been frozen in districts because of the fiscal shortfall over the last 4 or 5 years. I think the most significant thing, and this is one of the points that we all know, Jim, statistics, they never lie, but the folks that use them can be kind of using them as lies. We're losing a lot of teachers at the top end of the salary schedules in their districts. So we're going to see some affect of what that means in regard to teacher salaries, teachers retiring. I think last year was the worst year we've had in memory of teachers that are leaving the profession. A lot of it has to do with the cases we're talking about. Teachers want to comply. They want to do their jobs, but it has to make some sense. They have to understand that, look, the evaluation system they're using on me is real, and it's going to accurately assess my performance. I don't think there's a teacher out there that doesn't support an accurate, fair assessment process. They do have a problem, though. They have a serious problem. When it comes to a device that everyone knew when it was launched, that it wasn't ready for prime time. So now we end up with teachers that are saying, hey, I can fight this, or this teacher that I just referenced, she has 6 years. Does she make 10 years, or she decides, I'm tired. I'm not going to be labeled ineffective based upon something that isn't a fair, accurate measurement, and they know it. So, there are problems manifest right now because of all of this.
297-5633, 877-217-5757, inkstershow@wrkf.org. We will take some inquiries from you in just a bit with Steve Monahan, the president of the Louisiana Federation of Teachers, 10 years on the job. How many members now in LFT?
Roughly 21,000.
And how does that compare with LAE?
My guy who keeps numbers, they're published numbers. I have no idea.
You're a little bit bigger, right?
Yes.
Largest teacher union in the state. And Steve Monahan has gone through the ranks, 10 years at the helm, and he has a job that, of course, is prominent and important, and we will talk with him about what's happening in the public school system in Louisiana with students and teachers when we return after this 90-second pause on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633, your number, inkstershow at wrkf.org. If you'd like to reach us online, here's an inquiry from John. He says, I understand that the parochial schools do not have the same exams that the state requires of public schools for student measurements and thus cannot be easily compared with public schools, even though the state takes public dollars and uses them to pay for parochial and charter schools. Additionally, I understand that the parochial schools have an relationship of poor to wealthy students compared to public schools in urban areas. How could poor single-parent students in large quantities ever compete or be compared to wealthy students who have college-educated parents? That's from John.
I think the question answers itself. All of what John said are true observations. And that becomes what's wrong with, I think, the current conversation. The current conversation, it seems as if the administration and the Department of Education has shifted into a philosophical role rather than a pragmatic evaluation of program, what's working, and what we can do to help educate children. I mean that by there is a predilection, it seems, to the belief that private schools, by their virtue of being private, are superior. So therefore, the state is willing to shift resources and money to private schools without any data to back any of those beliefs up. The demographics are obvious. We know that. We also know that voucher schools, the schools that John, I think, alludes to, that are taking dollars, are using anecdotals to demonstrate that these schools are great, the 94% smiling parent factor. Once upon a time, we used that for public education. We're not anymore. We're using weapons to evaluate public education that may or may not be valid, but we're not applying them to the product that it seems that our current administration and Department of Education is pushing.
Steve Monahan, president of the Louisiana Federation of Teachers, on the hot seat. Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, you're on the air with Steve. Hi, Phil.
Good morning, Jim. And good morning, Mr. Monahan. My question is, there's been this full-throated, so sincere pledge to poor, disadvantaged black students that they should have the opportunity to leave a failing school. What about the school? I mean, it's not like changing a set of tires because you don't like the tires that are on your car. I mean, that's a huge institution there. Are they going to just fire all the staff and then sell the building for a condominium?
So. Your response.
Well, I mean, that hits the nail on the head, and I think we can further the question and ask, what about the community? When we look at what the state is doing right now in regard to the letter grades on our public schools, but no letter grades on the schools of so-called schools of choice, The caller raises an interesting point. To that point, let me say this: there's a consequence that we don't even consider when we embrace policies like this. Only 15 states label their schools A through F. There is a real estate effect on your property when a school is rated. The difference, for instance, in Florida between a B school and a C school, exact sized home, square footage, and the rest, there is a depreciation of some $15,000 lost on your property if you happen to live in a so-called C school district. Now, we know these as established facts. So communities die and grow around a rating system that is suspect at best. So it opens up a much, much larger conversation with that call.
297-5633, still time to talk with Steve Monahan, president of LFT, 21,000 members across the state. John in Tangipahoa Parish. John, good morning. You're on with Steve.
Good morning, guys. How y'all doing?
Fine.
Good morning.
I have a question for Mr. Monahan and the LFT. I taught for 25 years and retired before I reached full retirement. And I was wondering if y'all have a plan, if the LFT has a plan for an evaluation mechanism that, that would be fair to the teachers in the schools.
Yeah, we have, look, we not only we have our own ideas about what that evaluation system should look like, but I, with 25 years in the business, I'm gonna answer as frankly as I can. We also realize that the plan that we hold and we prize, if we believe that we're going to insert such plan and have it installed as law based upon our, you know, push, I think we missed the entire what we've learned over many, many years. In order for something to move, if it's all the administrations, and that's what has happened with this particular plan, it came out just as we expected, not embraced by teachers, not embraced by community, and being questioned in the courtrooms. If we have any plan that isn't a product of all parties sitting down and understanding the needs of the other, and really doing that, which didn't happen in the passage of Act 1, we're going to end up in the same place. So I'm hoping I'm learning right now from this experience that when the politics changes, and I'm expecting it will, that we'll be smarter about how we go forward to deconstruct and reconstruct some of these bad ideas. If we do the same thing and try to force a political solution without the inclusion of parents and the rest of the community, it'll turn out the same way because there's going to be a resistance movement. So yes, we have a plan. No, I don't think it moves in isolation. I think it has to be, but we have to have partners that are willing to sit down and actually sit with us and talk.
Bill on I-10. Bill, good morning. You're on with Steve Monahan.
Yeah, good morning. I'm curious why schools that have public schools that have so-called traditional students, as well as gifted, talented programs, when they're graded, those numbers are all lumped together, and I think it gives a real skewed final grade to the school, which, among other things, just doesn't give parents an accurate yardstick by which to measure the school when choosing a school.
Steve?
Sometimes I agree with, you know, you're, again, there's an answer in that question. It's a question. I think the question should be aimed first at administration. Why? Why is that? Why are we, too, in a position where we adopted law to create letter grade to provide information, more information to parents, but it's really not doing that? Because those lumping factors, you can also complicate that issue and speak to the confusion of it. When you see headlines that read Valley Park Alternative School, an F, Baton Rouge High, an A, we're comparing apples to oranges and claiming we're giving parents more information. We really aren't, and that's the problem. Real information means you don't damage the student body that where you may have great students in a C school, if indeed the school itself isn't truly a C school. I mean, I think the root of the problem is on the letter grade system. In a letter grade system, as I said, there's a reason why only 15 states have adopted that idea. It's not a good one.
Randy and Zachary. Randy, you're on WRKF with Steve Monahan.
Yes, one of the things there about children and education now is the kids can't wait. They need to be educated now. Thanks.
There's not going to be a debate around that. I mean, that's a truism that we all, I think we, if we were sitting at the table, Randy, we would all agree and we would toast that statement. And then we get into, is that actually happening? And then why isn't it? And why aren't all children being educated now? Or I'll give it to you a different way, Randy, maybe we will agree. All children should have the same opportunity to be educated now, should be provided an equitable quality opportunity. And I think that's questionable in whether that's happening at all, particularly whether we're going in the right direction right now.
297-5633, a few more minutes with Steve Monahan, Louisiana Federation of Teachers president. Now, last month, you made note of a survey of more than 1,000 people nationwide, parents living in urban, suburban, and rural areas, identifying themselves as Democrats, Republicans, Independents. It shows that 77% of American parents support public schools, and that they believe that strong neighborhood public schools are a better choice than vouchers or charter schools. Now, was this a skewed poll, or is this the real deal?
I think it's the real deal. It was a national pollster that conducted it. There was, a 3.1, 3.6 margin of error. If you believe in polls at all, that one's as good as any other. I think that poll also, to give some more validity to it, was followed by two or three of others. We called them sort of a flurry of good polls for us that basically are saying one simple thing. Parents are tired, I think, and I know the ones I speak with, and it's anecdotal. They're tired of the whole quantification movement, the over-testing, the idea that there is another quick fix coming. They want schools that work. They believe teachers are the individuals who have the greatest responsibility and the greatest effect, and who they trust most. I thought in that same poll, by the way, Jim, I thought the most interesting thing for me, rated with the least trust to bring effective change was the political class. Governors, I think, had a 33% trust that the governor himself or herself could actually reform any part of education to anything that really matters. So, yeah, I think parents are behind their schools. They're not behind the quick fixes and the magic potions.
Tyler on Scenic Highway. Hi, Tyler. You're
Hi.
On. With
Hi, I just want to make a quick comment. My mom actually teaches in Livingston Parish at one of the schools, and most of the time it's because parents don't want to do a good job at home that kids have a problem when they get to school after. I mean, a teacher is only with them for so many hours a day, and you have a parent that's with them all the other hours, and yet we're blaming the teachers for them not behaving correctly, them not learning everything, when they should be kind of learning it at home and then bringing it to school after. And that's all I really wanted to say. Thank you.
Well, it's again, I can be the amen choir on this. The idea is very, very simple. In politics, you point at those things that you can actually offend the least amount of people by making the observation and advocating for the fix. And so pointing at a teacher, scapegoating the teacher, beginning with the assessment of teacher, every human being, every one of us, I think we all agree, the effect of the community and the effect of the parent on the child. That's where the rubber really meets the road. Good schools are good schools because parents care. And I think that's the underlying secret to all of this. But that's a hard thing for politicians to actually do, because that means pointing at constituencies. And so I think that the observation is true.
Larry in Palm Forest, you're on with Steve Monahan. Hi, Larry.
Good morning. Good morning, Stephen. Jim, thank you for this opportunity. So it's one thing that I think that is wrong with our education is that you've got too many people in there that coming from. We're carrying these people from other states and whatnot without any experience and whatnot. Like the superintendent of education, that's awful for us to do something like that, bring him here with no experience, basing him on what he did in New Orleans. I didn't see anything to what he did. Didn't know. But anyways, Steve, what I'm concerned about, why can't we use the magnet or the whatever other system we have to do in within these special schools and things, and use it all over especially within the local community?
We can, and we could, I should say. We could. That's what's so important about the debate about the policies at the state level. I think districts can do that, and districts would like to do that, and outside of the EBR market, I'm also speaking of. But however, when the state of Louisiana points and has a vision that takes the emphasis away from public education other than the evaluation of teachers and the assessments of schools, and puts a great deal of, I guess a simple word would be rigmarole, involved in education and public education, and then pointing at another choice and holding none of those rules, none of the requirements that they subject our public schools to, the red, so-called red tape, which was once we were discussing a few years ago, to those very choices. So I think the point's well taken, and I think if the state would not be as large a big brother as it's been, local communities could perhaps get together and save their own schools.
A story that you may have an opinion about that I think is worth mentioning today. Yesterday, the state Supreme Court left standing a lower court order requiring LSU to release the names of semifinalists and finalists in its secret presidential search. Lori Mintz, an attorney representing the advocate in the Times-Picayune, says the Supreme Court refused LSU's request that it overturn or stay the trial court's ruling. The LSU attorney has a different opinion, Mr. Faircloth. But what do you make of this?
It's our world, Jim. I mean, that is the issue that the issue of the day. The whole fabric of government right now, and when we're saying we're interested in transparency, but yet the behaviors are less than transparent. I think that's the problem we've been dealing with the issues of Act 1 and Act 2. It is the same lack of forthcoming with real information. And what ends up happening as a result, we end up in the battle of rhetoric, where heated statements are made about the individuals who are asking for the information. I think the LSU situation is symbolic of an illustration of the greater whole. Things happen in closets rather in public forums. That's how these acts were passed, and that's why we're in the courtroom.
Well, Steve Monahan, always a pleasure. Let's do it again soon, and I'm sure there will be major issues permeating in the days and months to come. There always are in education, and this seems to be a particularly interesting time.
We live in interesting times. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you. Coming next, we'll have John Word of The Advocate as Steve and company saunter off into the sunset for another day at school. This guy was in Baton Rouge a few days ago.
Baby, let's cruise away from here. Don't be confused. The way is clear. And if you want it, you got it forever. This is not a one-night stand. Baby.
John Wirt now joining us. That's Smokey Robinson with one of his signature songs. There are a few of them, but that one is well known. I like his version a little better than that of Huey Lewis and Gwyneth Paltrow.
Smokey is a great artist. You know, of course, I've been aware of Smokey Robinson and the Miracles forever, or it seems like at least 40 or 50 years, since his first hit was 1960, Shop Around. The first hit for Motown Records out of Detroit, which became an amazing powerhouse of the American music business. So Smokey, I did some extra research, you know, to write a little piece about him last week prior to his appearance at LaBerge. And it's amazing how many songs he wrote, the productions he did for other artists, the songs he wrote for other artists like The Temptations and Mary Wells. He is just one of America's great, great talents. And at 73 years old, last weekend at LaBerge Casino, two nights, Friday and Saturday, he performed. He was on it. His voice is still great. He loves performing. That's obvious. And the people loved him. It was a big love fest.
Smokey Robinson, born William Robinson Jr., hit the charts with Shop Around in 1960, 53 years ago. He was only 20 years old. We'll talk with John Word about how Smokey was in Baton Rouge a few nights ago. 297-5633 is our number. Back in 90 seconds on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. John Wirth, the entertainment writer for the Baton Rouge Advocate, is with us, and of course his work is featured in today's Advocate in the section titled Red, formerly the fun section. Is a rose by any other name still a rose, the red section?
There are some differences in the section. A lot of the content is the same, and fortunately I'm still involved. I'm glad of that. So
well, we are too.
It's 28 pages long today, which is pretty normal for the fun section. Now the red section, yeah, you know, the John Georges, of course, has bought the paper, and he's brought new management in, and the idea, the higher purpose of it all, is to have a great newspaper, and not just a great newspaper in Baton Rouge, but New Orleans, and they intend to expand in Lafayette as well. Now, if Gannett had come in and bought the paper, our paper in Lafayette would have disappeared completely, and we wouldn't be in New Orleans, I'm sure. So this is, it's really an exciting time, and it's, for me, it's a rather nervous time, too, because I want this to work, because I believe in newspapers and their purpose, their contribution to the community. It's very important for our country to have strong newspapers.
I'm with you. 297-5633 for John Wirt of the Baton Rouge Advocate, who I would suspect has written probably close to 1,000 reviews, maybe a little more than that, of music and film through his career. Would that be accurate?
I've got maybe 6,000 bylines in the Advocate, and I had bylines in the Daytona Beach News
Journal.
And
almost all of those are reviews, right?
Well, I do a lot of features and previews. I've got hundreds of bylines in the Richmond Times-Dispatch, my hometown.
You could put them all in a book, the John Wirt Collection. You could. What about Smokey Robinson? You said at 73 he was on his game. Did you see both concerts?
No, I just went to the Friday concert, and it was wonderful. People were so excited. Now, this was an older group. I didn't see many younger folks there. These were people who probably grew up with Smokey, and the excitement they demonstrated was really contagious. You could, it was great, and it was great to be there because Smokey Robinson is living cultural American history, and again, he's so important to American music. And he's gotten plenty of honors for it as well, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and on, which he definitely deserves. But I think people probably don't always know how much he's actually done. All those songs that he wrote, mm-hmm. the songs he wrote for The Temptations, for instance, My Girl. And he performed My Girl. And believe me, it went over well.
I'm sure it did. A few weeks before Smokey, none other than Kevin Costner, the actor who dabbles in music, appeared at the Texas Club. John interviewed him. And you went to his performance, and I read the review, and I don't know if you were being charitable to Mr. Costner, but you said he wasn't bad.
He's very serious about his music. He's got a real band that puts on a real show for, I think it was 90 minutes, if I remember correctly. And he's basically in the ballpark of Tom Petty, and some of his things sound like Bruce Springsteen, kind of. Which makes sense because before he was a famous actor, he was doing music, and he was doing music at the same time as Petty and Springsteen back in the 80s. So you might think, well, is he copying Springsteen? Is he copying Tom Petty or John Mellencamp? But I think that's generally where he is in his music. So it was a nice show. It was a very nice show. I can't say that he's got a great voice. But, you know, Bob Dylan doesn't have a great voice either. A lot of singers don't have great voices. It's the manner of their delivery and the songs that they have that make the difference.
He's now 58 years old. How did the audience respond?
You know, it wasn't as large an audience as I thought it might be. The Texas Club is a large place. It holds hundreds of people. There was a good-sized crowd there, but certainly nowhere near a sellout. I saw some very excited ladies there. Kevin at 58 still has some very devoted female fans.
Yeah, he's still a big star with a fine body of work as a movie actor. He's a good one on the screen. And he is now trying to be a music sensation. He said he did this years ago and dropped it because he got a bad review. Isn't that something?
Well, I think a lot of performers don't read reviews or ignore them or don't care. But on the other hand, Kevin Costner and musicians and actors and painters, they're all human beings. And I think to be in the arts in the first place, there's a certain amount of sensitivity that you need. You need to be receptive to things. And I believe him when he says that he was hurt so profoundly by this Los Angeles Times review. I can believe that.
Mm-hmm. The Texas Club. Now that's a venue. It's been around a long time. One of the longest standing places for music in this community. In fact, our producer Kevin Gallagher, not to be confused with Kevin Costner, has a history with the Texas Club.
Really?
We're going to get his recollection of an event there many years ago. If Kevin will grab the microphone. But how does that compare with, say, La Berge or the Manship Theater or some of the other places around town?
Well, one of the things Kevin Costner said during his show is, it's great to be in a real rock and roll club. He's talking about the Texas Club. Of course, the Texas Club is more identified with country music. But they have different things there, different genres, and they have rock. It's Texas Club is a, I guess you'd call it a classic Texas-style dance hall. Not that I've been in Texas all that much, but it's a really solid place, I have to say. And a fight did indeed break out during Kevin Costner's show. And it was cleared up just like that. I mean, they know what they're doing. I guess they have some experience with such things.
Maybe that was part of the show. I wondered if the hecklers outside of Bill Maher were part of his show. And we'll get to Bill Maher in just a bit, too. I think we've talked with you a bit about him. But he did stir the passions of part of Baton Rouge in his performance here in January.
Those people were from Mississippi. The protesters.
Yeah, they were, these religious folks outside, and they weren't part of the act either. I thought that maybe Maher had paid them, but
he was looking for it. He was hoping hecklers would show up, or protesters. What they were, they weren't hecklers. Right. Hecklers, they weren't inside. They were outside protesting with their banners and things like that.
All right, and we will get Kevin Gallagher's recollections of the Texas Club many moons ago when none other than Merle Haggard performed there. And that's a perfect venue for him. And that was probably before your time.
I saw Merle play at the Baton Rouge River Center Theater. And that was a great show. I know we talked about that already. That was a little while ago now that Merle, August of 2012 or 2011, I'm not sure.
Well, let's go back. Kevin, when was Merle Haggard at the Texas Club?
Well, I can't give you the exact date because it was too many years and too many beers ago. Let's just say it was somewhere in the early mid-90s.
So we're talking maybe 20 years ago, and he arrives at the Texas Club, and Merle Haggard is one of the great performers of this time, and he goes through two or three generations as far as his success. He arrives at the Texas Club. How did he react when he sat down and realized he would be performing before a crowd at that particular place?
I can't believe you're getting me to tell this story on the air, Jim. This was backstage in the green room, and, of course, some of the radio announcers from the radio station that were sponsoring the event, where I happened to be working at the time, we were back in the green room with Merle and his entourage, and he looks at a man next to him. He's sitting down with his kind of hands on his knees and contemplative, like the thinker. And he looks up at a man next to him, I'm assuming is a manager, a road manager, and he says to him, "How in the hell did we get booked into this place?" But then he went on and did an awesome, awesome show. You would have thought he was playing Madison Square Garden the way he performed.
I'm sure. He's a consummate professional when he's drinking and when he's not. Dave near LSU. Dave, you're on the air with John Wirt. Hi, Dave.
Good morning. I had a very good experience earlier this month, probably the most fun concert I've been to in a long, long time, with Bill Kitchen at the Red Dragon Listening Room. Bill is the former lead guitarist of Commander Cody and the Last Planet Airmen. It was just a fun show. I really enjoyed myself. Thank you.
Yes, I went to the show, and I interviewed Bill prior to the show. And Bill was a great interview. Bill is 65 years old, but he is a guy that's just gotten better with time, and he keeps working at it. And we ran an interview in, I think it was one of the last issues of the Fun section. It would have been maybe 2 weeks ago. We ran an interview with Bill Kirchen, and he talked about how he keeps learning and keeps learning new tricks and says, oh, that's how you do it. But I did go to the Red Dragon show. I was there at the show. I didn't write a review of that particular show, but it certainly warranted a review. But I wasn't scheduled to do a review for that. But I have to say that I was just completely knocked out by 65-year-old Bill Kirchen. He is a master of the Telecaster guitar, no doubt. It's one of the best concerts I've ever seen.
You covered the Essence Festival. John covers it all. And Beyonce was the main attraction. How was she back after her Super Bowl appearance? The light stayed on this time. How was she?
Beyonce's I think she's a wonderful performer. She certainly gave it her all. And it's interesting that she sort of protested because she asked the crowd, why aren't you guys more excited about, basically, why aren't you more excited and enthusiastic about having me here? And I assume they were just tired because the Essence Festival goes on and there's so many amazing activities, not only at the Superdome, but at elsewhere throughout the city. And Beyonce was the culminating act Sunday night, the last act, and it was late. It was 11 p.m. or so. So I think people were just tired. But I certainly couldn't complain about Beyonce's performance. I think she gave it to the people.
Audra McDonald was with the Baton Rouge Symphony in May and put on a sterling concert at the River Center, and you gave her high marks.
Yeah, she's a wonderful performer, has lots of Broadway experience, and she sings standards, and she sings contemporary pieces, songs, and shortly after she was with the Baton Rouge Symphony, she was on public television on a big special from, I think it was Lincoln Center, just days afterwards.
Yeah, she's strong. She plays all over the country, Carnegie Hall, you name it, she's one of the real treasures of music and performing.
Did you see the show? Were you there?
In Baton Rouge? Yes, I did. She was great.
You were impressed, okay.
Yes, I know.
The people liked her.
Here's a question from Alice asking, who was better, Bill Maher or Bill Cosby?
I would say Bill Cosby. Now, Bill Cosby is a classic, great American comic and actor and all that, and he's got such an amazing history, so I certainly enjoyed the Bill Cosby show more than the Bill Maher show. Bill Maher gets so angry, and I don't think he's funny when he's angry.
What's the best film you've seen in a while?
You know, I saw Fruitvale Station.
I saw that too. It's a great film.
Yes, a great film, and I look forward to seeing more films from this director. He's a young director, and it could be that he could be one of our great directors in the future. I want to say there's a film that will be at the Manship Theater in September. It's called 20 Feet from Stardom, and it's about backup singers who sang, for instance, for the Rolling Stones, Gimme Shelter. Gimme Shelter is a classic by the Rolling Stones. Well, Mary Clayton, a native of New Orleans, is the female voice on Gimme Shelter, and she's featured very prominently in this documentary called 20 Feet from Stardom. I think it's going to only be one night at the Manship Theater. People will be able to see it later on cable or Netflix, whatever. But I do recommend it, especially if you love music and you're interested in the backstory of music,
yeah,
which is what the backup singers
well, we'll
are.
That one, 20 and Feet from Stardom.
Many of these backup singers, they work with Michael Jackson, Joe Cocker, the Rolling Stones, as I mentioned, and on and on and on. They have the most magnificent voices. It's amazing how great they are. So I do recommend this film coming up at the Manship Theater.
Have you seen In a World?
I've read about it, and it sounds interesting. You might know more about In a World than I know. It's a smaller film. It's a documentary, I think. So I don't know when it's going to get to Baton Rouge. Or if it's going to get to Baton Rouge, to be honest with you.
It's not a documentary, but Lake Bell is the writer, producer, and star, and it's a fabulous film about voiceovers.
You've already seen it?
I've seen it. I saw it in Washington.
Okay.
And it was best film I've seen in a while.
Wow.
Blue Jasmine, have you seen that?
That's the new Woody Allen film, and unfortunately I didn't get to see it. It's not going over the way, for instance, Midnight in Paris went over. That was a huge late career hit and really wonderful Woody Allen.
Well, speaking of
movie.
Hit, Alec Baldwin's in the movie. He hit another photographer, and he plays essentially Alec Baldwin in the film very well, I might add.
In Blue Jasmine?
Yes.
Okay. I want to see this, but unfortunately I missed it. To make a Baldwin connection, I spoke to China Phillips, and China Phillips is married to William Baldwin, Alex's brother, and she's at the Manship Theater tonight.
That's right.
With Big. Wilson Phillips, which is China Phillips, Carney, and Wendy Wilson.
That is tonight, and I'm sure you'll be there. And
I'd like to be there,
Angela Bassett, by the way, opened a can of worms with Woody Allen, who's one of my favorite directors, and I think Angela's got a point. She says you look from What's Up, Tiger Lily, 1966, to Blue Jasmine, 2013, 47 years of work, and he's been churning them out year after year, and I can't remember a black person ever being featured in a Woody Allen movie other than in the background.
If he were from
Alabama or Mississippi, people would be castigating him for that. But he's gotten a pass, I think, because he's from New York City.
He's in his own little New York intellectual writer world, filmmaker world.
What's going on with Woody Allen? He needs to put Angela Bassett in his next film.
She'd be great.
Thank you, John Wirt. We'll talk again soon, I know, and we'll look for your review of Wilson Phillips. Until Monday, for Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Engster. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members. Thank you.